There isn't a lot of collaboration that happens across sectors and silos and raises our ambition towards something that would be compatible with the type of challenges that we're facing. And so Regen Melbourne Now is effectively a platform for ambitious collaboration in service of Melbourne.
This podcast is recorded on the lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. We acknowledge the traditional owners of this country and pay our respects to elders past and present. Welcome to Under One Blue Roof, your podcast exploring the problem of climate-driven homelessness. Here, we ponder some of the big questions about housing, social justice, planetary boundaries, and more, and listen to stories from experts in the field who explain just how it's all related. Let's get to know the human face of climate change.
Hi, and thanks for joining us Under One Blue Roof. I'm your host, Marushka Saldana, a Master of Environment student and social enterprise practitioner. Let's dive into today's episode on how place-based research is creating the cities of the future. I am very pleased to be joined on the show by Kai Lofgren. Kai is the strategy lead at Regen Melbourne, an alliance of more than 140 organisations working together to create a thriving city within planetary boundaries. Kai is also the entrepreneur in residence at Small Giants Academy, where he collaborates on the Academy's education and storytelling initiatives, including the Impact Safari program and the Mastery of Business and Empathy. A civil engineer by training, Kai holds a Master's of Economic History from Lund University, and has previously worked in social enterprise, impact investment, and community development with Engineers Without Borders. Kai, welcome to the show.
Thanks so much for having me. This is going to be fun.
It will be. I'm excited to sit down with you and have a chat about all things place-based research. It's a pretty interesting area and one that I myself don't know a whole heap about. Something that we talk a little bit about as part of this podcast right throughout is this concept of home, which I feel is quite a funny one because most of us have a home and it's something that we're quite attached to in ways that we don't even understand. And for that reason, sometimes we don't always look at it as a human right or a privilege. You know, those are things that we don't necessarily associate on a day-to-day basis with going home, coming home, whether it's starting your day, ending your day. It's a thing that allows us to enjoy life to the fullest. Getting to know you a little bit, Kai, what's your favorite thing about being home, wherever that is for you? And I know you've moved around a little bit and had a very, I guess, interesting experience in terms of career, and perhaps that's changed your perspective a little bit on what home means to you. But how has that changed over time? What does home look like in Kai's life?
There are lots of ways one can consider and think about it. My first thought goes to where I grew up in St Kilda in inner Melbourne, inner South Melbourne, and the dynamism, the vibrancy, the life of an inner city place like St Kilda, and also the connection to water and the bay, the Port Phillip Bay, and how much of a part of my childhood, you know, that place was, a sense of safety and home, but also fun and life and being in the world. There was a real combination of effects there that means that even when I drive through St Kilda today, although I don't think it's somewhere I necessarily want to be anymore, there's a deep connection to story and family in particular. And I think as I've sort of grew up and then entered into what has been, as you describe, a kind of a meandering career through lots of different interesting places, I've been very lucky in that regard. I think a sense of home has become much more about the people that I'm with, and in particular my family now that I have my own, than it is about a particular location. And of course, we can talk about housing and homes as, you know, importantly being about safety and security and as you say, as a right. And then I think we talk about the relational aspects of home, which you know, overlay that, which I think are actually at an emotional level what we are craving. And so for me, now that I have two boys who are 8 and 4, and my partner, we home really is wherever we are. We've moved a little bit in the last couple of years, as many people have in the pandemic. And I think finding home has been really just a safe place for us to be together. And maybe the last thing I'll say is, you know, I'm Swedish by heritage, by background. And so I have a deep, strong cultural connection and pull back to southern Sweden, where my father was from originally and where I've studied and where I've taken my kids for a long sabbatical pre-COVID. And so I think, you know, my sense of home is also deeply connected to that part of the world. And if people have been there, you know, I fly into Copenhagen. So you fly over the water that separates Denmark and Sweden, and you see the long bridge that connects Malmö and Copenhagen these days. And you get off the plane, you get on a train and go across that bridge and into Sweden. And that experience is powerful for me, you know, arriving back to a place that I consider very much part of my life and a sense of home. So a few thoughts on that question that probably requires a much longer conversation in and of itself.
It's so fun going back home. And I know what you mean, because I'm about to get on a plane myself this year and go back to India. And it's immediate that, you know, the smells and the people and the accents and just the things that trigger memories from when you were a kid, you know, and you miss it. You really do when you're away for too long. And home can be anything and anywhere. Placemaking, we're going to talk a little bit about, and we understand placemaking as strengthening the connection between people and places and creating communities. And communities are about people. It's about how we relate to each other, but it's also about how we make those places more livable and more sustainable. So what does Regen Melbourne do in this nexus between livability and sustainability? And how can place-based research be used to create thriving cities and communities?
So the first thing I'd say is that I think this is an emerging area that's gaining a huge amount of traction right now. And there are institutes being set up and think tanks writing about it and case studies popping up all over the place. And we're at a particular moment where this idea of having a place-based approach or a community-led approach or lots of ways of framing it, where that feels instinctively like the right thing to do, that leads to an emergence of thought pieces and frameworks and models and all sorts of things that I think, you know, I'm happy to dive into and are very relevant to a conversation like this one. But I do think the starting point for a conversation about it is the importance of context, because it's not only important to the formation of Regen Melbourne, it's the formation of any community activity is reliant on the context within which it's in. That's the most sort of interesting part of the foundation, I think. And that's context both in the macro, so the state of our planet and our planetary boundaries and the role of our neoliberal economic system in creating certain wealth centralization or concentration and inequality as a result. It's got to do with the intersecting nature of all of those global challenges that really put us in a really difficult and quite existential moment, kind of a radical moment in human history. And that global context is essential to understand. And then, of course, there's the micro context, which will then inform how places organize or don't organize in relationship to that global environment. And so I can speak with some level of authority around the Regen Melbourne story and the Regen Melbourne context within which we emerged. However, I can't speak with authority about the context that other places and place-based organizing has emerged from, because it wasn't where I was. So I think it's just important to distinguish this is not from where I stand, it's not a sort of replicable thing that can just be rolled out. And place-based organizing, of course, there's practice and skills that you can learn. But I do think if it's authentically place-based or community-led, then that emerges from place, doesn't emerge from outside. So with that preamble in mind, the context within which Regen Melbourne formed is really critical. So if I rewind the tape, you know, 2.5 years, and we find ourselves at the end of 2019, I remember sitting around with my family, a beach shack that my mum had. we were sitting there at New Year's Eve and you started to get reports of the scale of the Black Summer fires.
It was a fire season like no other. 33 lives lost, 3,000 homes destroyed, 1 billion animals killed, and an estimated 30 million hectares burned.
That were emerging on the East Coast. Initially, it was reports that were just like any other summer reports, that this was, you know, the latest fires are coming and here's the ABC radio reporting on it, etc. And then, of course, it became clear quite quickly that these were on another scale. And so the fires, as we now remember them as the Black Summer, spread up and down the East Coast to such an extent that the global media became very interested as a really clear example of what the macro climate emergency looks like on the ground. And the two things that stuck out about that experience, and you would remember them, was that for the first time, we were really quantifying the loss of animals.
Now, we're going to look back at the Australia bushfires because new research has found that the crisis killed and displaced 3 billion animals. That's three times worse than previously thought.
In numbers, now we're talking about billions and billions of animals lost in these fires.
Worldwide Fund for Nature says it looked at the period from September to February. The WWF calls it one of the worst wildlife disasters in modern history. An estimated 2.46 billion reptiles were killed, 180 million birds, 143 million mammals, 51 million frogs. It's hard to comprehend, isn't it?
A sort of mind-boggling figure, but really shook, I think, our sense of what is really lost when we have these sorts of events. And the second thing, of course, was that we had smoke that sat on top of our major cities, Melbourne and Sydney, for a long period of time, for days and days on end, which caused breathing difficulties for people with asthma, and people really struggled and were actually wearing masks, you know, weeks and weeks before COVID emerged. So we had these sort of really significant fire events, and it affected not just the communities that were immediately affected, which were obviously devastated by the fires. It also affected these urban centres. And from a Region Melbourne perspective, that smoke was a deeply catalytic experience, I think, for what then emerged later in the year. Of course, then a few weeks later, we started to get reports of the COVID pandemic and what that would mean for us. And Melbourne went into a first lockdown and then into a prolonged second lockdown. And that experience of lockdown and the policy responses of COVID and the policy responses to the pandemic exposed a whole bunch of things that basically also shook the foundations of what we understood our system to be capable of protecting us, of keeping us safe, of managing things like inequality and access to healthcare and all the things that started to become apparent. And the lockdowns, of course, affected different people in very significantly different ways, depending on where we are in the socioeconomic spectrum and in the geographic spectrum across a city like Melbourne, had profoundly different effects. And I think just as we understood those things to be true, but hadn't necessarily felt them, or everybody hadn't necessarily felt that. And in a similar way with the fires, it's not like we didn't know that the climate emergency would lead to these sorts of events, but we hadn't necessarily felt it on that scale yet. The felt experience of those two significant disruptions were, I think, deeply informative to the context that Region Melbourne then emerged from. So that was the backdrop. And the backdrop is important because nothing kind of comes from nothing, if that makes sense. So then we had these wonderful forums that I was privileged enough to be part of convening in the middle of 2020. And in one of these forums that I was running through an organization called the Small Giants Academy, we invited Kate Raworth, who was the author of Donut Economics. And actually, we also invited Kate's husband, Roman Krasnarik, who is a philosopher in his own right and had just released a book called The Good Ancestor, which is about long-term thinking and how we can all become good ancestors. And so we had a great conversation with them and 100 people in a Zoom room about this idea of Donut Economics and long-term thinking in a time of crisis. And in that session, there were many conversations about other cities around the world that had started to take these ideas of Donut Economics and look to localize them in place. And that was the seed. That was the seed of Regen Melbourne. A bunch of organizations then got together and said, well, why don't we try this in Melbourne? Why don't we nurture the energy that's emerging for some sort of transformation and couple that with the Donut Economics structure and methodology, which we can dive into, to really interrogate what would our vision for a regenerative Melbourne be? And how would we act together in pursuit of that, given the crisis that we're experiencing? So that was a lot. I'm not sure if that's exactly where you wanted me to go, but I feel like the context piece is critical.
Context is very important, and I feel like you put it perfectly. There was so much happening at the beginning of 2020. And from one catalyzing event around the bushfires, you go straight into the pandemic and boom, you sort of have the perfect storm, if you like, for people wanting to gather and form networks and alliances and start to think differently about how we solve problems. And it seems like Regen Melbourne was really born from that. And I really need to get my hands on that book you mentioned, How to Be a Good Ancestor. That sounds like a fantastic read, and like everyone should read that. When you talk about Regen Melbourne and how it emerged from donut economics, which I will admit was very sad that that does not relate in any way to edible donuts, and still getting over that in some ways. But can you walk us through what exactly the donut economics model is and how it works and what it means?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's a really intuitive, interesting, engaging look at the discipline of economics. But I would also encourage people to ignore the word economics if that scares you, because there's plenty of ideas in here that are super valuable and intuitive for people who are, you know, deploying other forms of practice in pursuit of a regenerative place. And so think about the donuts, ignore the economics bit, and I'll sort of talk about how they can be integrated somehow. But Kate was an economist working with Oxfam for a number of years in microfinance and other areas, and she's got a beautiful TED talk on donut economics as well for people who want to just dive into that version of the story. But effectively what she was interrogating were the assumptions that underpin the discipline of economics that lead to many of the systemic challenges that I talked about when we were chatting about context. And she really wanted to see whether there was a way to rethink some of these assumptions. And there are lots of principles and ways that she does that in the book. But the fundamental one that people, I think, are drawn towards is this idea that our entire economic system at the moment is geared towards growth. Growth at all costs. That's the only measure of success. And so that is a fundamental assumption that is effectively taking us off a cliff, because on a planet with finite resources, to have an entire system of economics, of politics, of business leadership, of even leadership in the nonprofit space geared towards growth is inherently unsustainable and will very likely put us across a number of tipping points in the near future from which the planet might not be able to remain livable or thrivable for human beings. If you interrogate that, you say, well, if it's not growth, if growth isn't the goal that we should be incentivizing and pursuing, then what is it? And what she talks about is that the goal for all of our systems needs to be towards what she talks about as the safe and just space. And the safe and just space is made up of a baseline, which she refers to as the social foundation. And so this is effectively, she borrows the sustainable development goals and makes them into the social foundation. So many people would know the SDGs, but if you don't, they're a set of principles that were drawn up by every country in the world that basically defines where we should be heading in terms of a social foundation. So she borrows the SDGs and she creates the social foundation. So in your mind, you can draw a circle and that becomes the social foundation. And then she says, our goal should be to bring everybody above that social foundation. That's sort of principle number one. But if we bring ourselves above that social foundation without also thinking about the fact that we have ecological boundaries on a finite planet, then the risk is that everyone comes up above a social foundation and we blow straight through the ecological boundaries. And that would also be massively problematic. So everyone might have what they need to thrive, but if they're on a planet that isn't compatible, then we have massive challenges. And so she realized that we then need to also put in place this idea of an ecological ceiling that goes above the social foundation. So now we're drawing our second circle. In your minds, you can draw the inner circle, which is the social foundation, and then you draw an outer circle, which becomes the ecological ceiling. And to inform what an ecological ceiling is, she once again borrowed from another framework, which she took from the Stockholm Resilience Center and a bunch of scientists who put together what they call the planetary boundaries. So the planetary boundaries are 9 different areas of ecological science, looking at what are the tipping points that we need to avoid in order to maintain a livable and thrivable planet. Things like climate change and ocean acidification and ozone layer depletion and chemical pollution and a whole bunch of things that make up that layer beyond just climate change. And so if in your mind you've got this visual of an inner circle social foundation, an outer circle ecological ceiling, then the safe and just space is the space in between those two layers. And hence we've now got like a donut shape. It's like a cinnamon donut if you're a donut connoisseur. Like it's got a hole in the middle and it's got the safe and just space is the doughy bit of the donut. That's the model in and of itself. And what that means is that one can start to see the interconnections between all the social domains, things like water and food and health and energy and mobility and housing. And you can see how they're connected to each other and also how they're connected to the planetary boundaries. And so it's a really quick, intuitive systems view on what our macro challenges are and what we should be pursuing. So that's the donut in a nutshell. That's the first principle, going from a growth as a goal to a safe and just space as a goal.
That's what blew my mind initially when I first heard about this, because I'm an economics student and I was taught nothing about donuts for the 3 years that I survived that experience. And the idea of a growth model is so inherently wrong in so many ways. There's so much that we know doesn't work about that. And when you think of the donut and you think of circularity and how we might live in this space, as you mentioned, where you've got social foundations that set up society for success and you maximize those, but you minimize your impacts as a society on the environment, and those 9 planetary boundaries you mentioned feed into that in a way that just makes so much sense.
That's exactly right. And one of the principles that she talks about is also this idea that instead of being growth addicted, in other words, that's been the unifying principle, we need to be growth agnostic. So there are lots and lots of there's interesting scholarship and there's interesting communities building around principles like degrowth and post-growth and green growth and all these different models for how you might tweak it and fundamentally reform it, I should say. And I think what we're talking about with donut economics as a mindset is that there's no doubt that certain sectors of our economy and certain areas of the world need to have growth as part of their work. So we can't ignore the idea of growth. It's just that having it as the only measure of success for everything, everywhere, that is a real, really problematic idea. And we've allowed our economic system to pursue that for way too long, and also to pursue it to such an extent that it is now an unchallenged assumption in our politics, in our economics, in our business leadership, that is the only way to be successful. And it's the only way to get to a thriving system. And so I just wanted to distinguish between, and I guess also note that there are lots of conversations going on globally around what is the role of growth and what does post-growth or degrowth look like. The donut takes a kind of an agnostic approach to that. There will be areas that need to grow and there will be areas that don't need to grow. And that's that nuance we have to get more and more comfortable with.
I think human behavior as well is a big part of that. And our, I guess, you know, obsession with consumption and taking more than we need often is a problem at the very center of that donut, perhaps. And everything, you know, in a way stems off our own actions and behaviors and mindsets. And shifting that is a really important place to start. So moving on to what we're going to explore next, often we know that social and environmental issues have in the past, historically, perhaps even continuing in some ways, have been examined and addressed in these silos with very little attention to the compounding effects that one dimension, the social dimension, for example, has on other dimensions like the environment. So what is your perspective on using social ecological models of effective change intervention. And I think Regen Melbourne is a really good example of this. Are there any particular strengths that come with using this type of research-based approach and interdisciplinary framework that you think really work well?
Another big question. I feel like I need to complete the Regen story so that we can interrogate that one with some examples rather than just speaking conceptually. And I feel like another one of my sort of personal reflections over the last 12 months swimming around in this work is there is a lot of conceptualizing going on and theorizing and framework building. And I think that is an unbelievably important part of the ecosystem. And on a good day, love diving into that world. And I also feel like we need to start creating and sharing the messiness of real examples and being honest and, I guess, honoring the process of living this stuff out in the world, because it's not easy, it's not clean, it's not pure. It's messy because the world is messy and our system doesn't make this work easy. So if I can complete the story and then I'll bring some examples to the table and hopefully that can get into some of the nitty-gritty of those questions. So when we decided that this was something that there was enough energy to pursue in late 2020, we set in train a sort of structured community research process, which was supported by the Lord Mayor's Charitable Foundation and the City of Melbourne to basically run a sort of six-month community research process. And we ran big Zoom forums. We did lots of leadership interviews. We held round tables. I think in the end, we had about 50 organizations and about 500 people involved in these conversations. And the conversations were basically, what does a regenerative Melbourne look and feel like? And we broke that down using donut economics methodology and case studies from places like Amsterdam and Portland, who had done similar processes in the previous 12 months. And so we borrowed a few models and a few Miro boards and workshop structures, and we used them. And we ended up with a huge amount of lived experience insight into when we feel like we're living in a healthy city or an unhealthy city, when we feel like we're living in an empowered city or an unempowered city. So we looked at all these sorts of questions. The resulting report, which came out in April 2021, was called Towards a Regenerative Melbourne. And it included a treasure trove of great content and insight. But the three key assets, I guess, or building blocks that came out of it was a collective vision for Melbourne, like what is a regenerative Melbourne? And we can maybe share them in the show notes. It's a beautiful visualization of what we think a regenerative Melbourne is. And it's about Melbourne being a knowledgeable city, a city that's full of life, a city that's affordable, a city that's connected through its culture, that's collaborative, and that all of its systems enable this vision to come to life. So it's a really quite a sophisticated, thoughtful examination of what a regenerative Melbourne is. So that was the first building block. The second building block was the Melbourne donut. So we looked at Kate's model and we localized it to the city in a few quite specific ways. So for example, we found that many people answering questions on what a regenerative Melbourne is kept coming back to the role of art and culture. And art and culture, for a range of reasons, doesn't show up particularly well in the SDGs. And so we thought that if we're going to have a Melbourne donut, one of our social foundations needs to be the role of art and culture and the health of our art and our cultural dimension. So that's been inserted into the Melbourne donut. We also include a red band around the donut that kind of creates a three-dimensional dynamic aspect to the donut, which is we think is important because it creates more of a living system rather than a framework. And that donut also represents this idea that in order to reach a social foundation or stay within an ecological ceiling, we ultimately need to heal and reconnect to each other and also to this place, to country, honouring the First Nations people that have been here for 80,000 years and continue to hold a huge amount of wisdom that can support us to achieve this goal for everybody living in a safe and just future city. And so there are a number of aspects that we incorporated into the donut model in order to then think about how do we act on it. So that were the first two building blocks, a vision of a regenerative Melbourne and this purpose of moving Melbourne into the safe and just space of the Melbourne donut. And then the third asset was a roadmap. There were like 12 different areas of activity that this emerging network wanted to pursue together. And so we took these three building blocks and said, well, there seems to be enough energy here for this to be more than just a COVID research project. And so we brought together a group of Melbourne-based funders who supported a two-year pilot to explore how this network, how this emerging system could be valuable to Melbourne. And we're a bit more than halfway through that two-year pilot period now, working on a whole bunch of different ways to activate the network in pursuit of this beautiful vision that we created together. And so getting to your question, I guess where we've landed now is that the best way of acting towards the safe and just space and not just visualizing it is thinking about what are the bold, intuitive, ambitious, collective goals that we want to pursue together that any single actor couldn't pursue alone. That's kind of the role of collective power and networks and alliances. There's a lot of beautiful grassroots activity going on in Melbourne. Melbourne's an unbelievably progressive, innovative place, creative place, but there isn't a lot of collaboration that happens across sectors and silos. There isn't a lot of collaboration that happens across sectors and silos and raises our ambition towards something that would be compatible with the type of challenges that we're facing. And so Regen Melbourne now is effectively a platform for ambitious collaboration in service of Melbourne. And we host really ambitious, practical projects that raise our collective ambition, enable us to work together to achieve things that we otherwise wouldn't be able to achieve. And so I'll give you three or four examples of what those projects look like. So early on in our journey, a number of our community partners were working on the idea of how do you regenerate the river, the Yarra River, the Birrarung. And those actors were already working in that space. They've been doing it for a long time. And they were starting to talk about, well, what would a stretch goal be that could combine our strategies towards something that achieves all of our individual visions, but enables us to act more coherently together? And so the idea of, or reintroducing the idea of making the Birrarung swimmable again in the near term, in the next 8 years by 2030, became a really intuitive, playful, crazy goal that we could think about acting on together. So one of our goals, one of the goals that sits on the platform of Regen Melbourne is to make the Birrarung swimmable again by 2030, which to your question talks to not just the river health and the water quality, but it speaks to our social relationship to the river, our cultural relationship to the water over the last tens of thousands of years through First Nations custodianship. It talks to the legal and governance layer of what you can and can't do in certain places and how policy is set. It talks to campaigns and storytelling. You know, how do we actually generate a groundswell of momentum around an idea like this? And of course, it speaks to specific ways that you might be able to swim in the river. So it's got all of these systemic elements. So although it's a singular goal that everybody can get behind, it contains your question of what is this relationship between the social and environmental layer, and how do you give people pathways to be active in a sophisticated systems project without necessarily doing, you know, masters and PhDs in systems thinking and transformative economics, because most of us don't have the ability, time, capacity, privilege to be able to do that sort of thing. So Regen Melbourne is setting up these projects as pathways into a conversation like this one or a question like yours about how do we act towards a safe and just space between a social foundation and planetary boundaries. So that's one of the examples that we're playing with at the moment.
That is really exciting. I think everyone knows of the Yarra, the Birrarung, and how integral it is to the culture and the place that is Melbourne. You know, the river runs right through the middle of the city. You can't go anywhere without coming up along it or passing it or crossing it. It's so central to our understanding of what it means to be a Melbournean. You know, there's these dynamic interplays between the social element and the environmental aspects of any area that we look at in cities and what makes cities sustainable. So I think what's happening at Regen is really exciting because there's some very ambitious work that is going on, and to set that as a goal is really, you know, saying, well, this is what we need to be working towards, because there are a lot of organizations out there doing the work and doing great work, but how do we bring them together and create spaces that we can collaborate and collectively work towards those ambitious goals that we set. And that's certainly one of them.
That's right. I feel like it's a really great case study in a systems problem and a way to kind of interrogate and break down a systems problem, but retain the joyfulness, the community, the connection. And that's what place-based work can do, because we can all feel what it's like to walk along the Birrarung, and we can intuitively imagine what it might be like to swim in it. But actually, from a Regen Melbourne perspective, we're not that interested in the swimming. The swimming is a really nice outcome of a huge number of changes that would need to happen in terms of our relationship to the water, our relationship to power and risk and business and capital and all the dimensions that we know need to be reformed in the broader system that we're in order for us to exist in a safe and just space. And so to some extent, you can think about the idea of swimming in the river as a little bit of a Trojan horse goal. You know, it's a goal that we are deeply committed to as an alliance, but our ultimate goal here is not swimming in the river. It's a bunch of systems transformation that we know is required in order to live in a safe and just city. And that goes for all of our goals. So we're talking about another project is called Participatory Melbourne, which is all about the rejuvenation of our democratic fabric as a city. And once again, we'll be running a whole bunch of different things that speak to social dimensions of the Melbourne donut, like political voice and social equity and equality and a whole bunch of really interesting aspects of the social foundation. But of course, democratic rejuvenation is required to achieve any of our social foundations and any of our planetary boundaries if we deeply think about it. And so there's an intertwined nature to how this work works as well. They're not just separate projects. But to raise that one as another example, we're also working on food systems and food waste. We're working on a project called Village Zero, which is how do you transition neighborhoods and streets to regenerative streets or holistic net zero? And how do you create replication models across small communities in a big city like Melbourne? So our goal by the end of this year is to have a portfolio of these ambitious projects. That's what we're aiming for, and we're well on the way. And each one of these projects will have a lead convener attached to it, somebody who's actually responsible for the art of collaboration and the systems convening and the funding architecture and all these great words that we know are important in order to do collaboration well. And that whole piece of work is powered by our alliance, which is now almost 150 members, organizational members in Melbourne.
That is awesome. And one of the pillars of what Regen is working on at the moment that really excites me as someone in the social enterprise, housing and homelessness space is the affordable pillar and the work that's being done around what the city will look like in terms of affordability. And for me, I immediately think of housing affordability, of course, and knowing that homelessness is everywhere when you walk around Melbourne City, it's incredibly visible. It's something that you can't necessarily walk down the street without seeing. And 7% of the homeless population in Australia is rough sleeping. So they're out on the street with no safe, secure shelter. And affordability is a big part of that problem. So we know it's a problem and we know it's not safe and sustainable. So how do you begin tackling something like affordability in the city of Melbourne? What's the process involved? How does it start?
So the important disclaimer in a conversation like this one, which is sort of now in housing, is that I'm not an expert in housing. I'm not an expert in food. I'm not an expert in democracy. What we feel like we have a really important role to play in is this idea of the importance of systems thinking, creating unique coalitions, and this idea of raising collective ambition and the process of doing that. That's kind of what we feel like is our contribution to the ecosystem and acting as an alliance. And so that's sort of I just wanted to sort of state quite clearly that I'm not an expert in housing. And so everything I'm about to say is more about the kind of process of how Regen Melbourne would examine a question like housing rather than about the challenge itself. But it is worth coming back to the core vision that was co-created by 500 people a couple of years ago about what is a regenerative Melbourne and what does it look like. And as you rightly say, one of the six pillars of our vision statement is that a regenerative Melbourne is affordable. And I'll just read you the sentence that was put together by the community around that pillar. It basically says that everybody has secure, safe, comfortable housing powered by clean energy and quality locally grown food. And so I guess the important part of that when I read it is that it goes well beyond shelter. And so maybe looping back in on our conversation around home, I think there is a vision here to think about the role of housing to not only create a sense of home, but also to connect that with the idea of our energy system and how we engage with our energy system and the energy transition. It's got to do with our food system and edible cities and the waste systems that we're occupying. So all these different dimensions, very much from a donut mindset, are interconnected. So when we say affordable, I don't think we're saying simply, you know, let's tackle the gentrification crisis, although that is part of it, or let's tackle the homelessness crisis, although of course that's part of it. It's about how do you create an affordable ecosystem that people can live in that connects up many of these domains that are actually really critical if we want people to live lives where they feel like they're thriving. And there's also, I guess, the other thing that is sort of sprinkled through our vision statement is this connection to the natural world. So that's probably the other piece of that affordable question is how are we connected to nature through our housing system in a way that's very conscious, not just from a technical perspective, lowering, you know, heat stress from increasing canopy cover, but also about the spiritual and emotional connection to country that many of us, I think, have lost and need to regain if we're going to achieve the broader vision of Regen Melbourne. So that's kind of starting at the vision level. That's probably how Regen Melbourne as a community was interrogating that question. In terms of tackling an ambitious goal, like ending street homelessness or something like that, I guess the way that we think about it is because we're not experts in any of these dimensions, what we're currently or what we're doing all the time is sensing into where the Alliance has expertise and energy and supporting the Alliance to think about what would their ultimate ambitions be if they could unleash the power of a collective on a challenge. And so there are members of the Alliance that work in the housing space who are, of course, thinking about those questions. What is the ultimate ambition? You know, if I use the river as an example, we can use it as a bit of a parallel. They were already thinking about what does the ultimate regeneration of the river look like? What is that collective stretch goal? And so what we started to do as Regen Melbourne was convene small groups of actors around those questions, build a relatively small scale consensus on what a broad, ambitious goal for Melbourne might look like in that space, and then enroll more and more actors, almost like concentric circles around that core group. And what that led to was quite a major design forum on a swimmable Birrarung in November last year, which brought together actors from local and state government, from business community, from the startup community, from the nonprofit community group community, and also a number of individuals. Brought them together in a room and started to interrogate what is the vision here, what are the systemic challenges we're trying to navigate, and what are potential pathways around those challenges that we can circumnavigate together to get to our goal, and what are the activities that map to those pathways. Big, beautiful process that basically now produces small working streams where actors in Regen Melbourne can be enrolled in a small part of what is a big systems project. And so they might just continue to do what they do, but now in the knowledge that they're contributing to something bigger, or they might pivot what they're doing or start a new collaboration to fill a gap that's been identified through that systems process that we are the convener of. That's a work in progress, right? That's a wild experiment. But I guess from a process perspective, that's how we start to sit at that more systems level rather than project level, whilst retaining the tangibility of a really specific goal. So you can kind of apply that to any potential stretch goal that the city would have in housing or in food waste or in democracy. And you can start to see how having a platform for that collaboration, a platform for those processes is absolutely essential in order to get to that level of systems impact rather than to stay at that very whacking of symptoms that are coming out of the current system or working on small scale projects that might have deep local impact. And we're certainly not discounting that, but struggle to have an impact on the broader systems challenges that are at play.
Taking apart a problem by its components, I think, is something that really stands out about the approach that Regen uses and place-based approaches more broadly, because you're looking at a problem from a lot of different perspectives with a lot of individuals and groups in the room that have their own deep knowledge of how these systems work and how it affects the people that they work with through their programs and networks. So there's a really multi-layered approach that seems to feed into this, and that's really exciting.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think there's a really interesting tension that we are dancing with all the time. And I think anyone doing any systems thinking work dance with all the time. And that is that we kind of live in a way of thinking about the world that is problem-solving focused. What we're taught in our economics degrees or in my background in engineering or in any other technical discipline, it's about breaking problems down into solvable chunks and then organizing resources effectively to solve those chunks. And then the assumption is that if you solve enough of those problems, the system gets better. But of course, what we know when we dive into systems thinking is that it's not so much about like mechanics, using the analogy of a machine, and how do we fix a machine? Well, we look at its parts and we make sure all the parts are working well. That's the way we've envisaged the economy. It's actually not a machine, right? It's a dynamic, complex organism with feedback loops that we can only begin to understand. So we can definitely delve into it, but it's not something that is controllable with levers and buttons in the way that we think about a machine. And it's funny how, you know, we hear economics editors or politicians, they often talk about, they use those analogies, right? They talk about, I'm going to pull this lever, or they've, you know, adjusted a rate of something, and that's going to, as if there's these direct, very linear loops, and they're not, they're dynamically complex. And so I think in our work at Regen Melbourne, we absolutely look at how do you break down a broader systems challenge, but we do that with the full understanding that everything is interrelated. And the dynamics, feedback loops that exist within a systems problem like making the Yarra swimmable or the Birrarung swimmable, they are complex and they are not solvable like a machine. And so hopefully the ecosystem we're setting up around some of these wicked challenges honors that reality and allows for a kind of open learning, experimenting mindset rather than an engineering, economics, problem-solving mindset. That's our hope.
And it comes back to that messiness, doesn't it? Because a lot of what our models and our frameworks and our tools tell us is that there's a certain way that you can solve X, Y, and Z. But in reality, it's so much more complex and dynamic, as you say. And I think choosing the Birrarung as a first project is poetic in a way, because the river, it ebbs and flows. It's a dynamic force of nature. And that really represents, I think, the work that's happening in this space. There's people who are contributing in a really meaningful way and thinking about these problems differently, because the way that we've addressed them thus far have been quite informed, I guess, by our anthropocentric, man-made, come in with our sort of big ideas and be quite bombastic really about how things work and what we think we know. But there's so much of that that doesn't work. And so coming together in these forums and as collectives, particularly in a localized way, I think creates that momentum that starts to shift the needle even just a little bit.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Well said. And I think if you don't have a groundedness in place and examples of quite practical change that you want to see in the world, like ending food waste or making a river swimmable, and as I said, if it's not geographically connected, then these ideas risk being the domain of people who only have, as we said before, kind of a level of privilege to just play with ideas. And I think it's our responsibility for those of us who have the opportunity to play with those ideas to also make them accessible and allow other people to play with them, right? Because we don't have the answers. But in order to get other people enrolled, we need to make them really accessible and joyful, right? Like it's also connection to human beings and to place should be an experience of joy, despite the massive context that we find ourselves in.
Couldn't agree more. To come to the end of our conversation, we ask each of our guests about their vision for an equitable and sustainable climate future. And I'm going to do the same with you, because activating local alliances and networks is a big part of what makes place-based approaches so effective. And in your opinion, How do we continue to use that to ensure that human settlements are not only resilient, but also inclusive and just, and particularly as we talk about this just transition in the economy, what do you think is required for cities to really thrive?
My bias on this question is that the vision that we've created is pretty great at Regen Melbourne. And the fact that it was co-created by, you know, a very large number of people at a particularly formative moment just gives it a large amount of weight in my mind. And so maybe that's the easy question, but, you know, the Regen Melbourne vision of Melbourne as a place that, you know, where everyone has access to knowledge as custodians of our environment and society, which is the first pillar, so that the city is knowledgeable, that it's full of life, that we have a network of neighbourhoods that support thriving communities and natural ecosystems. We even include a sentence here around, you know, we can swim in our rivers, play and learn in nature and grow food in our city. You know, that idea that a city is full of life is something that I think, you know, we can often walk around dead shopping centres or strips and just like, where is the life? Where is the play? So I think that's something we have to strive for, that it's a city that's full of life. You know, we spoke about that a city is affordable and we talked a bit about that. I'm particularly interested in the pillar that we have around a regenerative Melbourne being connected through culture. You know, we're obviously proud of our diversity of culture, but we're proud of them as drivers of connection and creativity, not just as an act of tolerance, that it's actually a part of our fabric and a driver of who we are collectively, and that we live as much a part of the land as the land is us, which speaks very much to this idea of reconnecting to the idea of being part of nature, being part of the natural world, even if we might live in a big urban center. And so that pillar around being connected through culture is just this beautiful expression of something quite deep. And then the fifth one is around being a collaborative city. And so we are, you know, we do what we love for our livelihoods, but we're also valued for our contributions beyond just, you know, economic value. So it's more than just income and work. It's about how we think about value and value exchange in our city. So the idea of a regenerative Melbourne being collaborative. And then the sixth one that was added quite late in the process, if I remember correctly, is that a regenerative Melbourne is also enabled. So what we meant by that was that our economic and our governance systems are designed explicitly to enable the vision to come to life. So it's not just a vision of, you know, a speculative future or a utopian future. We're also thinking about the mechanics, like how does our economic system and our political system and the other enabling systems around us support that vision of being a really, really important one. So I'm sorry that wasn't an off-the-cuff answer, but I feel like I'm here representing Regen Melbourne in this conversation because of the contributions of many, many, many people. And so I feel like that vision really captures so much of what is magical about the Regen Melbourne ecosystem and the work that we're doing now.
The future that you describe is a place I definitely want to live. And I hope that within our lifetime, we see it start to happen. And it's already happening. The work that's been done is incredible. And the impact creates that ripple effect that will ensure that our cities are, you know, more sustainable, cleaner, greener, and more livable and better for people. So I really appreciate your time, Kai. It's been a pleasure and a joy to talk to you and hear about all the incredible things that are happening at Regen. So thank you.
And thank you so much for having me on. And would love just to extend the invitation. You know, Regen Melbourne is what it is because of the people who want to be involved and get involved in the Alliance. So if you're an organisation and you want to join, then we'd love to have you. If you're an individual who wants to come and contribute, then that's what makes this work so meaningful. So please jump on the website and check it out, and always feel free to contact me. I'm pretty sure my contact details are everywhere at the moment on the website and elsewhere. So feel free to reach out and say hi.
I think they absolutely will. Thank you, Kai.